The Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division will come to order. The other committee that was in this room before were a little over time, so we're taking a few minutes to get settled down, but in your packets is a compilation of the results of assignment one, and those of you that were not here for assignment two, there may be time at the end of the meeting for us to hear your presentation. Assignment three was for the committee only, and readings were distributed to you so that you could prepare for today, which is kind of an overview of what happened in the Great Depression under the New Deal, and the various government programs that reached out to people to help with jobs and community organization preservation and recovery and reinvestment. And Representative Lilly, did you bring something that is just an expansion of what we're doing today besides just listening and having dialogue?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. This was given to me by my father, who's a clock collector, and it is, we can pass it around, but it's with the president in which we're talking about, and I've always enjoyed this artwork. We have a piece in North St. Paul of some of the art that you're going to probably talk about today, and then I printed this out. My dad winters in New Mexico in Deming, and so they have a piece of art of in the museum there, or the post office, and I guess the post offices were all the same, right? The buildings around the country, and then the art would be applicable to the local area, and this would be have Yucca and the mountain, and then in White Bear Lake in the back here, it'll show with the Voyageurs or something. So the same, you can see the doors are all the same, and the post offices were all built the same, but the art would be...
But they had regional art.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyways, I just thought this clock was fun. It's missing some parts. I left some upstairs, but kind of a fun piece.
That's great. That's just great.
So I get extra points, I guess, is the final.
Well, indeed you do. And you know...
Phyllis, oh, by the way, Madam Chair, Phyllis, I thought this was pretty good, but then Phyllis had, as usual, she outdid me. So she'll have the final answer, I think.
Representative Morgan says it's a very timely item. Representative Kahn.
I just, Madam Chairman, I don't know if you pointed out to members of the committee, but the in room 400 South, I believe it is, the prints that are all around 400 South with WPA prints that were in the Historical Society.
Right.
And so when this building was being done and we were looking at the print, the art for it, that was one of the things that was done, was the framing of those prints and putting them in that room. But anyone, when you're in 400, I think, anyone who cares to look at those.
Right.
Then there's a little plaque which talks about the WPA site.
And I'm especially pleased to have these excellent speakers before us tonight because I am a product of growing up thinking that Franklin Roosevelt was some kind of a hero. Actually, I thought Franklin Roosevelt was a house builder because I live in a home that I showed you my yard last week, right, in my picture. And I live in a home that was built as part of a project of the Work Progress Administration. There were 84 houses built. And my parents were eligible for a house because they had, at the time, before me, four kids and a job, but they didn't make too much money. My dad was a steel worker working at the Duluth Steel Plant. And so they applied for a house, and about 200 other people or families applied for a house too. But there were only going to be 84 houses. And my parents' names were pulled out of a hat for this house. But my dad said it was the wrong house. They had 2-bedroom houses and 3-bedroom houses, 5-acre lots and 10-acre lots. It was understood that they would clear the land, they would have animals, they would have a garden so that they could be sustainable. But they also had to have a job. And the house, the price of the house that they would eventually pay, if they homesteaded the land for 10 years, at least 10 years, the house was based on the number of children and what their salary was. So my dad said he already had a 2-bedroom house and he needed a 3-bedroom house, and so he would try again. And so they put their name back in the hat for the second drawing, which was a week and a half later. And lo and behold, at the second drawing, Lloyd and Gertrude Murphy's name were pulled out of the hat again, and it was matched with a 3-bedroom house and 10 acres. And that is the only home that I've ever lived in, and I've never been away longer than 6 weeks. But my dad used to say, when the neighbors, especially like in the 50s, when people were getting the new Youngstown kitchens, instead of the wood-burning stove that we had, they were getting these fancy, not wood cupboards anymore, but these fancy steel cupboards, Youngstown, Ohio. And my mother'd say, Moline's are going to get a Youngstown kitchen. And my dad would say, Franklin Roosevelt built this house, and this is the way he wanted it. So you can imagine what I thought when I went to school, and my second or third grade teacher was talking about President Franklin Roosevelt. And I said, how could Franklin Roosevelt be president when he was the guy that built my house? That being said, hi, Berman. We're so happy to have you here talking about and setting the stage for what government could do and what government did and how we got out of the Great Depression and how cities and people were helped. And you will be followed by Pam Brumfeld and Professor Larry May and Professor Annette Atkins. And I'm so pleased to welcome you to this committee.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm very pleased that you welcomed me to this committee and invited me to come. For over 40 years, I've been teaching at the University of Minnesota this particular subject to students who thought that this was so irrelevant that they didn't pay any attention to it. Now it's become relevant. It's become very relevant. So therefore, I'm glad that I have an opportunity to talk about this outside the classroom to a committee of the legislature where something can possibly be done. Notice I said possibly. First of all, let me give the background. The Roosevelt administration came into office at a time of probably the deepest economic crisis in the history of our nation. A crisis that had already been in existence for almost 2 years, over two years, that had reached the point where unemployment had gone to a phenomenal rate of about 25-30%. Underemployment had reached the point of about 30-40%. So it was really a very disastrous time. During the interregnum, between the time that Roosevelt was elected and he became president, the bank system collapsed. So he was faced with an immediate problem. Now, he had no solutions to this problem. And in fact, he tried various different ways. There were some theories that he had, he and his advisors, and they acted on these theories, which didn't work. The theory, basic theory that he had was that the economy was suffering because of the fact that there was too much goods in circulation, and therefore prices were collapsing. Therefore, what should be done is to raise prices by artificially creating shortages. That was done in agriculture and industry as well. Recovery was to be done through putting into the hands of the large corporations and the corporate leaders control of the industries. It didn't work. The result was, of course, a major period of upheaval, discontent, that reached a peak in 1934 all over the nation, including in the Twin Cities, the Minneapolis truck strike, which was in the Twin Cities, which was one of the major ones. In addition to the growth of demagogic leaders that were trying to move the nation to a fascist direction, like Gerald L. K. Smith, Father Coughlin, Francis Townsend, it was this kind of disillusionment that led to the rethinking of where the New Deal should go. Relief for individuals in the first phase was essentially, pretty much, the goal, handouts, relief. Work relief was only an afterthought during the economic, deep economic depression of the winter of 33-34, when, in fact, the Civil Works Administration was established only for 1 year. Public works was considered a necessity, but public works was put in the hands of the Secretary of the Interior, Harold Ickes, who believed that the public works should be efficient and strong. Therefore, it wasn't immediately effective for stimulation. The Public Works Administration with large projects, like the Triborough Bridge in New York, or the Oakland Bay Bridge in the Bay Area, San Francisco and Oakland. But it was not immediately effective. In 1935, when the whole nature of the New Deal shifted, moved away from its original conceptions to the belief that there was a necessity to increase public spending to stimulate the economy, the public spending was going to be done in the way of expanding job opportunities for people, making work, even if the work was to be funded and the federal government was to be the employer of last resort. The focus of this activity was through the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, which was part of the Federal Emergency Relief Act of 1935. 1935 also saw a shift in the New Deal attitude towards other forms of social investment. 35 saw the passage of the Social Security Act. Social 35 also saw the passage of the Wagner Labor Relations Act, making possible collective bargaining as a means of also maintaining labor standards that would allow workers to live a decent life. This was the focus then of the New Deal after 1935, and the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, became the instrument through which work relief was made an integral part of the New Deal efforts. It was through these work projects that, Madam Chairwoman, your house was built. It wasn't Mr. Roosevelt himself that built it. It was construction workers. Now, the WPA was not only an agency to put people to work, the usual kinds of blue-collar workers, construction workers, to work. The belief was that other people as well, artists, teachers, yes, even historians had to eat. And they were put to work as well. and different kinds of projects that in fact had a great effect on our art, on our music, on our literature, and someone in the panel will talk about this aspect of the WPA. But the historians were put to work of recording the lives of slaves, for instance. Our knowledge of slave society and slave culture would not be available to us now if it weren't for that. Music historians were put together to try to gather the folklore of American culture. This was, of course, part of the Library of Congress project that the WPA was involved in. So there were many of these kinds of projects. So not only building of bridges and building of your homes and the building of the roads and the infrastructure, and of course the other kinds of activities that were light industry activities, like seamstresses working in different kinds of activities, but also the works of the artist, the musician, the teacher, the historian, was of course of great value. Now, there is a tendency to believe among some economists that the New Deal didn't work because it didn't get us out of the Depression. Yes, it didn't get us out of the Depression, but it put people to work. Getting out of the Depression was a function of other kinds of activities. It stimulated the economy, and the nation was better off after 1935 than it was before. One indication that, in fact, the nation was better off can be seen by the failure of 1937. Franklin Roosevelt was also a believer in balanced budgets. Therefore, he believed, after the success of 36 and early 37, that the WPA should be cut back. And he did. The end result was that there was a recession in 1937, a sharp recession that almost wiped out the gains that were made before that time. The lesson of that is that you can't cut back in the midst of a recession depression. That must go forward. That lesson was learned, and the WPA continued on until the wartime conditions made it unnecessary for the WPA to continue. There were other forms of efforts made. Now, on the state level, and that's what we're talking about here, on the state level, each of the projects that were done on the national level were administered on the state level. The WPA project had state and offices. I mean, one project that I'm very familiar with was the Workers' Education Project of the WPA. And the first director of the Workers' Education Project of the WPA was a young graduate student from the University of Minnesota by the name of Hubert Humphrey. I think we all heard of him. He got his start, his first job, with the WPA. I think then that there was something to the WPA that beyond just the building of bridges and houses. There's more to speak about the New Deal and its efforts during the Great Depression, but I speak about it quite a bit in the classroom, but I'm limited in time before this committee, so I'll stop now and turn the microphone over to Pam.
Welcome to the committee, Faculty Member Brumfeld, from up north, from Representative Venus District,
which makes me an Iron Ranger.
Oh,
another one. Anyway, thank you, Madam Chairperson, for inviting me to testify. I'd like to follow up on a couple of things Dr. Berman said, and it occurred to me that in many ways FER and the New Deal did not end the Depression. That is true. But using a phrase from our current president, FDR gave the American people the audacity of hope. And I think one of the best illustrations of that is Otter Tail County, Minnesota. For those of you who are familiar with Otter Tail County, you may know that it is one of the most conservative counties in the state of Minnesota. They voted for a Democrat for president just once in 1932 at the depths of the Depression. They realized by 1936 they've made a mistake. They have never voted for a Democrat since. So you have to keep in mind the backstory of that, because the Otter Tail County took advantage of every single New Deal program that was offered to them in the state of Minnesota, and it's the only county in the state that probably did. So they recognized a good deal when they saw it, and they used it. Every single deal, every single program. And how do we know that? Because the Otter Tail County Historical Society published a book with the help of the Minnesota Historical Society called The Grassroots New Deal Programs for the People in Minnesota. And Representative Murphy has one. It is the first history of the New Deal in the United States that actually took a look at what the effect of these programs was on real people's lives at the grassroots. Every other history of the New Deal has been told from the top down. And so that's why economists can get away with saying that it didn't get us out of the Depression. But the fact remains that the lives of the people who lived with those programs were transformed by them. Just to give you another idea of how devastating this was, in 1930, I've been researching the Depression for all of my professional career, partly because of the Otter Tail Project, but also because I'm fascinated by the communist mayor of Crosby, Minnesota. And so I've spent a lot of time studying the...
Current mayor, is that...
No. 1932, served 1932, 1933. The only one ever elected. He was rather... he was the rock star of communism. Anyway, I've studied the New Deal quite extensively. Carl Emil Nygaard. He was an interesting young fellow. Anyway, I studied the New Deal in terms of the Iron Range as well. And just to give you an idea of how devastating the New Deal was on the Iron Range, in 1932, steel plants in this country were operating at 22% of capacity in December. Imagine then that 78% of steel plants in this country were coal. It was estimated by the Steelings Mining Review that if the rate of steel consumption continues, there would be enough ore stockpiled at the steel plants and at the mines in the Lake Superior Mining District, especially the Mesabi and the Vermilion and Cuyuna here in Minnesota. There would be enough iron ore in the stockpiles to feed the steel plants for 5 years. Which means there's no need for iron miners to be working. So it was massive unemployment on the Iron Ranges. It's been estimated that 70% of all iron miners were out of... there was 70% unemployment on the Iron Ranges during the Depression. So it gives you a sense of how devastating that was. So as I open my remarks, I wanted to provide you with a little bit of that background so you would get a sense of how devastating it really was. I would like to address my remarks primarily to the programs that are of greatest concern to this committee, but there are lots of others. So I'd like to speak about the New Deal programs and how they worked at the new grassroots level to improve both the environment and the cultural life of Minnesota. The work done in the 1930s has had a long-lasting impact, even if most people today don't remember or understand who painted the murals in the post offices, built the stone picnic shelters in state parks, planted the Norway pines along the trails, or collected the historical information that forms the foundation of many archival collections in county historical societies across the state. The environmental, the artistic, and historical New Deal legacy in the state is largely due to the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC, and the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, and to a lesser degree, the National Youth Administration, the NYA. Other programs such as the Agriculture Adjustment Administration, Civil Works Administration, and Public Works Administration certainly played a major role in building the state's infrastructure. But the CCC, the NYA, and the WPA's programs were particularly directed towards improving the environment, increasing historical knowledge, creating art and literature, and expanding park and recreational programs. Historian John Solman argued that the Civilian Conservation Corps, created in 1933, was intended to, quote, bring together two wasted resources, the young men and the land, in an attempt to save both, unquote. The young men who were enrolled in the program were paid $30 per month, with $25 of their wages sent home to help their families. Alex Klimek from Otter Tail County described how it felt to be able to help his family. It was, quote, good. It kept them alive. It kept them going, unquote. Within the first year of the CCC, a total of $72,500,000 had been sent to families of the men enrolled in the program. I don't have any idea what that number would be in 2008 dollars, but it must be a massive figure. A lesser known facet of the CCC was the program designed to help veterans. The VA chose men to serve in veterans' CCC camps. Eventually, 225,000 veterans participated in the program in the state of Minnesota. John Solman contended, quote, to many veterans, the CCC became a rehabilitation center, a place where they could regain health and self-respect. Here they received a second chance, an opportunity to gain the knowledge, skill, or confidence they needed to earn a decent living, unquote. Most of the CCC camps the men lived in Minnesota were located in the Chippewa and Superior National Forest, State Forest, State Parks, and in one private forest. Remnants of some of the camps in the state still exist, such as the one at Royalton, and the foundations of the camps in what is now Judge C.R. Magny State Park can still be seen. Eventually, 61 camps were built across the state, with nine of the camps located in farming areas or in flood control areas. Two of the camps in agricultural areas were located in Otter Tail County, where some of the men cleaned up the Otter Tail River. Minnesota Commissioner of Conservation E. Victor Willard commented, quote, as a result of the CCC work, water is flowing into the Otter Tail River in places where it was completely dry, unquote. Soil conservation work was also done by the CCC. Fences were built, terraces constructed in hilly fields to control erosion, and wooded areas were cleared and seedlings planted. By the end of 1933 in Minnesota, a report revealed how successful the program had been in its first 6 months. The men had fought forest fires, repaired or installed 165 miles of telephone lines, created 48 fire breaks, cleared 3,914 acres of timber slash, and 211 miles of dead or damaged timber, cared for millions of tree seedlings, and removed thousands of acres of gooseberry and currant bushes to cut the spread of blister rust in white pine, built 20 dams and 25 bridges, inventoried 12,708 acres of forest, and made improvements to beaches and lake shores and in forests where they weeded and trimmed 1,508 acres of trees. And that was just in the first 6 months of the program. After hearing those figures, it is not hard to understand why the program has attained mythic status for both the men whose work was valued by the government and for the American people. It provides tangible, long-lasting results that can still be seen across this state. The NYA, established in 1935, was a smaller program and was much like today's work-study program. The program allowed needy students to stay in school and employed young people who were no longer in school. The NYA particularly benefited young women who were not eligible for the CCC. Students, for instance, worked on small construction projects and sewing programs. They also provided recreational programs in towns and parks across the state. The federal government spent $662,300,000 on the program between 1935 and 1943, and 4.8 million people were helped. In Minnesota, young people like Lorna Anderson Olson earned a total of $14,317,097 in wages. Olson from Fergus Falls, who worked in a park program, commented that the program gave her, quote, an opportunity I wouldn't have had. NYA work helped the family, but in the long run it helped me. It was fun working with those kids, and I learned a lot about people. It was a good experience, and but going to college opened a new door to me. That was something, unquote. While the CCC and the NYA primarily provided young people with important work in Minnesota's forests, farmlands, parks, and towns, the WPA provided employment for adults who are often not eligible for work in the CWA or PWA. The WPA began with, in 1935, with $5 billion in funding. Employees were divided into five groups, and their salaries were based on the skills they brought to the work. Among those employed were stonemasons, teachers, librarians, office managers, college teachers, lab technicians, architects, professional artists, writers, and actors. Some of the writers who worked for the WPA were John Cheever, Conrad Aiken, Saul Bellow, Ralph Ellison, Studs Terkel, and Richard Wright. The Federal Writers Project was created in 1935 and provided 6,600 writers, editors, and researchers with work that resulted in a massive accumulation of historical research, as well as the American Guide series for all 48 states in Alaska. Cities, cultural, and specific regional guides, such as Minnesota's Arrowhead Country, were also written during the course of the Writers Project. In the end, the Writers Project produced 275 books, 700 pamphlets, and 340 articles, leaflets, and radio scripts. Andrea Kalin explained why the Writers Project mattered. Quote, it was where social and economic history met the individual imagination in literature, unquote. In Minnesota, the WPA administered the Historical Records Survey, which still benefits academic and local historians, genealogists, and historic preservationists. At the Otter Tail County Historical Society, the WPA newspaper index is often the first resource checked for information. And the files are filled with WPA-generated family biographies, business histories, and surveys of local governments. An architectural card file of structures in Fergus Falls generated by WPA researchers provides information about the built environment in the city in the mid-1930s. Books such as Anna Himrod's The Cuyuna Range, A History of the Minnesota Iron District, published in 1940 by the Minnesota Historical Records Survey Project, and an unpublished manuscript, The Finns in Minnesota, now located in the files of the WPA Writers Project at the Minnesota Historical Society, are still used by researchers. The Writers Project and the Minnesota Historical Records Survey Project generated a body of work that continues to provide the people of Minnesota with valuable insights into the state's past. Besides the Writers Project, the WPA provided artists with a way to make a living, and their work can be found in post offices, government buildings, and schools all over the state. In Virginia, for example, the mural of the history of mining on the Mesabi Iron Range, located in the elementary school, was painted by Duane Breyers. You may be familiar with Duane Breyers' work without realizing it, because he went on to become a widely recognized commercial artist whose most famous character was Hilda, the, quote, big and boisterous, unquote, calendar girl. The Otter Tail County Historical Society sent historic photographs to Charles J. Grant in Minneapolis, who painted 12 oils and 5 watercolor paintings based on the images. He also rendered an expressionist image of the 1919 cyclone that fully captured the horrors of the storm that destroyed most of Fergus Falls. The mural in the Ely Post Office illustrates the flora and fauna of the Boundary Waters in an Art Deco style that reveals its WPA origins. In Deerwood, the WPA helped the city to employ skilled stonemasons to build a beautiful auditorium and city hall out of 800 tons of stone. Between 500 and 750 men and women worked on WPA projects in an average year in Otter Tail County. In 1935 and 1936, the WPA pumped $957,938 in wages into the local economy. In the summer of 1939, workers spent $17,221 on food, $7,507 on rent, $4,416 on both clothing and fuel, and $1,766 on both transportation and medical care. All of the money spent certainly helped the employees survive the depression, but it also helped professional men, landlords, and store owners stay in business. The New Deal programs had a massive, immediate impact on communities across the state and created a legacy that is still with us today. The investments in people's lives and the environment, in history and art, and in great writing will continue to enrich all of our lives far into the future.
Great. Oh, Professor Larry Main.
Well, that's a tough act to follow. I don't know if I can do it, but thank you, Madam Chairperson, for inviting me here. Let me say that there's two prongs to the New Deal arts program, both in the state and on the national level. The first one is that it had its focal point in many departments in the federal government, the most famous one is being the Works Projects Administration, and that was consciously designed to provide employment for workers and white-collar people who had become unemployed in the Depression. So it had a very self-conscious side to it of being a stimulus package, a welfare program that would put people back to work. The other side of it was cultural. And this was a very self-conscious side to the people who administered it, both the artists who engaged in it and the people who were in charge. And the cultural side was, there was a deep awareness that what the 1930s had brought into the political arena and into civic life was a whole group of new people who had never before participated in as citizens in the United States. Let me give you some examples. We know from the voting of the new immigrants, people from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, who would have populated, say, for example, the Iron Range, that about 20% of the people in that population voted. The New Deal brought that up to about 90%. It also mobilized into the political arena as citizens African Americans who were migrating from the South. It also brought into the political arena the Native Americans who had often been isolated on reservations but were moving into the cities. And on top of this, besides bringing them in the early New Deal, there was the awareness of what kind of an America are we going to create and what kind of an America are we going to build. And this naturally fell, and it was part of the consciousness of people who were engaged as the directors and the artists in charge of the federal programs and the local and state, that what we want to do is bring in the common people in to give them representation in the arts and also give them a way to understand that they are the can be active creators of the world that they were in. They weren't just passive. And what this did in terms of the arts, there was this welfare or work get us engaged side of it, but there was also this side of we're going to try to create a new language to understand the society we're in. And this is the side of it that had a kind of huge impact that's ramifying not just through the arts programs, the New Deal, but through the arts of this period, which is to break away from Europe. If you look at most of the art museums in the state of Minnesota or anywhere else in the country, and if they're created prior to the 1930s, the murals on the walls, the representations are generally from classical representations of mythology, or they represent the elites or the people who run those towns. What the New Deal did was shifted it, at least the arts of the 1930s, was shift the focal point down to the common people. And this is why you have in so many of the art projects just very common things at work, where people are doing the labor in their common communities, the arts, and the expressions of the local areas. And this was shifting the validation or who was really the Americans to include new people. So while you've got this work side, you've got this inclusive side. And let me describe the things that happened, and then I'll describe to you the inclusive process. First of all, the New Deal at the local and at the federal level inspired or created a number of organizations or agencies devoted to the arts. The Works Projects Administration, the Federal Theater Administration, the Federal Writers Administration. Thousands of people were put to work through these tasks, but also they were put to work in ways of trying to conceive, and there's a strong documentary impulse to the arts of the 1930s. Documentary in the sense of, let us understand this new world that we have entered. In that case, it was this industrial America, this new interdependency that all Americans shared, and the artworks were trying to give some type of form and understanding to that. So you get the American Guide series, which we saw an example of from Minnesota. You also had art classes throughout the state of Minnesota and throughout the nation, where you would have artists go in and they would teach art and this new way of seeing the world to students in high schools and in museums. For example, there was one of the art centers for this state was the Walker, and it wasn't fully in its form now as a museum. And you had radio station WCCO there on weekends spreading out to the population exactly what was being taught. So you both had local art, and you would also have it moving out through the new mediums of mass communication into the larger population. There was also a heavy emphasis on bringing the new Americans, and one could think about the ways in which something like this might be applied to current environment in Minnesota, because we've had a whole new wave. I mean, I've been here 30 years, and I was just looking at the way in which Minneapolis ethnic and racial neighborhoods have changed over that time. You think about, if this was the art projects of the New Deal, these would be the people that would be coming in to these art projects and creating representations of their lives in this new America. For example, in the Works Projects Administration, the arts division, 41% of the artists and the people employed were women, which was quite striking if you look at other areas of employment in the United States at the time. Also, you had in Harlem, you had many major artists put to work. For example, Aaron Douglas, who becomes a major muralist of African Americans and artists in the post-war period, was working in Harlem. In the Southwest, you have Indian artists that are painting murals in post office. You also have some of the iconic images of the 1930s are done through these arts programs. For example, Dorothea Lange is engaged in the agricultural component of the project. You also have artists like Ben Shahn who are working in New York City and in Brooklyn. You also have films that I show often in class that were done under these projects. Things like Per Lorentz, The Plow That Broke the Plains, which is a documentary about the way in which Americans have been destroying the land and creating flood conditions in the Mississippi Valley. You also have the Plow That Broke the Plains and The River by Per Lorentz. Another example of this isn't quite tied to these art programs, but it's worth mentioning. A whole innovation in theater design for both theater itself, that is plays, and also movies was initiated in the 1930s. When you small towns in Minnesota and all over Minneapolis, when you see these modern theaters, rather than the style that you see at a theater like the Suburban, which is emulating Europe, the modern theaters, which had murals in the 1930s, are built in the 1930s. They're part of this, what is America? America is this new machine, streamlined society, and we need to make it look beautiful. That is sponsored by the Federal Housing Administration. These are the mortgages that the theater owners get to build these theaters in local neighborhoods all over Minneapolis, but all over the country. When you go into a small town and see a modern theater, that has been built in the 1930s. It was not in the 1920s. Also, this was not just a place where put amateurs to work, but many skilled artists who became very famous in the post-war period. Painters, writers, were cut their teeth in the federal theater arts program. People like Jackson Pollock, for example, Stuart Davis, very famous painters. And then we had mentioned earlier writers like Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison, Saul Bellows. They're all working in these projects. So it isn't such a sort of sidelight that you're just putting people to work. So in conclusion, I would say just two things. I think that in thinking about how would you try to apply some of these lessons to the current situation, one, yes, we want to put people to work. I have graduate students, for example, that are working with me, and they're getting job interviews around the country, and in the last month, all the jobs have been canceled. The University of Minnesota is not hiring, is in a hiring freeze. That's happening all over the nation. So our people that we're now training are having difficulty getting positions. We also have cutbacks in public radio. This is another area that one could think about. Okay, we want to put people to work. But I think as well, we need to think about what type of art do we want to create. I think that we are in the midst of creating a new America. You can see the kind of people that came into the last election with the Obama. It is different now, and yet we don't understand that we're still working with a lot of the older categories, and the arts can help us imagine our ways out of this. And so I think you need to think about the arts. Okay, we want the bang for the buck, but what kind of art do we want to sponsor? Yeah, we want to go back to the people, but also think about these new people who are on the scene. All right.
Well, thank you so much. It's given us so much to think about.
Okay.
Oh, Professor Annette Atkins, Lessons Learned, Creating Minnesota.
Creating Minnesota, Mary knows, she has a copy up there. It's the book that the Minnesota Historical Society published last year of mine, which is a new one-volume history of Minnesota. And it's a book that I could not have done now without the work of the WTA then. And I'll come back to that in a second, but I want to start by recognizing Larry Hong, my own representative, is also, we should just take over this.
Yeah,
that's our representative. But also to say, Mary, I think that we all live in the house that Franklin Roosevelt built. We don't know that we did. We don't always recognize it. We don't always notice that the furniture is from the 1930s. But I think the power of what Larry, Pam, and I are all saying is to give us an idea of the dimensions of this house that Franklin Roosevelt built. So it may also be truer to say that it's, in some ways, the dimension of the house that Harry Hopkins built. Mm-hmm. Harry Hopkins, I think, was one of the real heroes of the Depression years. And what I love about Harry Hopkins is that he sort of looked around and he said, what do people need? And it's that question that moves him to begin thinking about artists, writers, historians, librarians, archivists. It was that question that took him out of a sort of government chair and put him into a much larger arena. It gave him a kind of vision that Roosevelt, I think, was captured by. So I think it was really Hopkins' vision that your contractor and builder, Franklin, learned from, but you always want a good architect. Now, one of the most serious problems I think that the New Deal people have to face is that the United States has a complicated history in relation to poverty. That we as a country have not known very well how to think about the poor. We haven't known very well how to think about helping them, how to think about locating them, how to think about what their place is in American society. A project that I did early in my career was on 5 years of grasshopper plague in Minnesota in the 1870s. A subject that might not, on the surface of it, really captivate all. fun. What it was actually, and finally, was a study of rural poverty. And I wanted to look at an occasion when people were poor to absolutely no fault of their own. If you're affected by a grasshopper plague, there's no way that you can have brought those grasshoppers to yourself. You can't have attracted them. Your bad farming practices couldn't be to blame. So I wanted to look at that period and to see how were those poor people treated in Minnesota. Well, I have to tell you, it was awful. One of the governors who was responsible for their treatment was Governor John S. Pillsbury. A man who was remarkable in many ways, but sympathy for the poor was not one of his characteristics. And he instituted a kind of needs-based relief system that required that people testify and sign that they had no other visible means of support. And it became the kind of watchword of that program that if you asked for help, it meant that you weren't really of the kind of moral fabric that we wanted you to be in order to get help. So the only people who should really be helped were people who were too proud to ask for help, but somebody else would ask on their behalf. No, it put people in a terrible circumstance. And the governor's papers at the Minnesota Historical Society Archives are full of people who were writing to the governor saying, I need help. I can't feed my children. I can't... You can imagine the stories that they told. So within a very short period of time, these people who were poor through no fault of their own got transformed by the sort of government apparatus into beggars, into paupers, and to people who were shamed by their poverty. Now, I wanted to understand why that happened. And the conclusion I think that the evidence carries is that in American society, if we can blame people for their poverty, we can then credit ourselves for our wealth. If, however, we say, well, that guy is just down on his luck, then maybe I'm getting ahead because I'm lucky. Well, I think as a country, we haven't been willing to say, maybe I'm just lucky, and maybe she is just unlucky. But that's the problem that poverty presents us with. That people who aren't poor, people who get ahead work really hard, many of them. People who are poor, who don't get ahead, often work at least as hard and don't get ahead. But so we can look at the successful people and say, well, look how hard they work. But I think we need to look at the poor people and say, look how hard they work as well. Now, it seems to me that part of what Harry Hopkins was doing was trying to slice through that notion of who's poor, why they're poor, what they're entitled to if they're poor, and to remove the shame that is attached. The way that shows itself, in part, is that he didn't ask historians, archivists, librarians, writers, theater people to go work on building roads. He respected and gave high enough regard to their skills, their talents, and their abilities to put them to work doing what they could do and doing what they could do best. And if there is a kind of insult in asking an artist to build a road, it's not insulting to build a road. It's important, valuable work. But to ask an artist not to use his or her skills, not to use his or her talents, is the insult. And so what Hopkins was saying, but there are so many talents, and there are so many abilities, and he wouldn't have used this term, but don't we have a gold mine of intellectual capital here that we run the risk of squandering if we don't protect? And that's what I think his interest was. We have so much talent, so much ability. We must take advantage of that. And if that means using government money to hire people to do murals, to redo the Walker Arts Center, to write these guidebooks. Let's do it.
Right.
In 1935 and 1936, and this really is the only figure I'm going to give you, Pam's done such a good job of giving you so many. In that one year, there were 65,000 people in Minnesota employed by the WCA on 1,700 different kinds of projects. Now, that's a lot of people, and that's a lot of projects, and a lot of those people were people who worked in the local library, people who worked in the county historical society, people who worked in the state historical society. Now, a few years ago, when in an earlier round of budget cuts at the state level, there was a woman named Patty Dean who was working at the Minnesota Historical Society who was let go. And she figured out a way to create a new life for herself. So she's now the director of a Western State Historical Society. But she is probably the most knowledgeable person about music, contemporary popular music in Minnesota for the last 50 years. And she's gone. That's just one example, but I could give you example after example. Now, we don't know enough, I think, that we can risk letting people go who have knowledge, ability, talent, and experience of that kind. But we've let many of them go. Like Larry, I'm thinking about my current student, one named Leah Guster, who's just about to graduate. We have been training her, educating her, watching her grow for 4 years. She wants to become a public historian, meaning she wants to work in a local or a county historical society. And she has organized for 4 years to be qualified and able to do this. She's done her internships at several places. She has done mock exhibits. She has done real exhibits. She's helped us launch a public history course. There are no jobs for her when she graduates. There is no county historical society right now. It's publishing. That's all there is. It's hiring. Now, I think that we need to employ people like Leah. She's talented. She's going to find her way if she doesn't. But she understands how important it is for all of us to know our history, for all of us to know about the house that Franklin Roosevelt built. Now, I'm going to end with just one. I guess I'm going to end with two things. One is this is the nice thing about going last. I kept crossing. Okay, I don't need to talk about that. I don't need to talk about that. So I can talk about two other things. One is to pick up on just a piece that I mentioned, which is about our understanding of American slavery. The premier historian of American slavery in the United States, who was at Yale for many years, who wrote really the definitive work on American slavery in the 1890s, a man named Ulrich B. Phillips, argued about the the benevolence of slavery. Now, he was a PhD in history, he was at Yale, he was at the peak of his profession, so we can't so easily dismiss him by saying, well, he's just a sort of racist cow, which he turns out also to have been, which any of us would have been in that same, sort of in his same situation. In fact, he is a well-known, highly renowned historian, but the sources that he had available to him primarily to study slavery were the documents and the records of the slaveholders. And if you read those documents and the records of the slaveholders, the story they tell is about the benevolence of the slaveholders. You couldn't read those documents and not come to that conclusion. Well, in 1972, a man named George Roblick published a book called From Sundown to Sunup, The Making of the Black Community. He was able to write this book because he went back and he looked at the WPA interviews that had been done in the 1930s with people who had been slaves. And that work was the sort of first, most important place that historians more recently found to find records other than those that U.B. Phillips had used. Right, that Browick ended up pulling together a collection of 20 volumes of those interviews, and those interviews helped him and a generation of historians recreate, re-understand, and reimagine the life of slaves. And it's a very different story. It's not a life about the benevolence of the plantation, but it's a story about the complexity of slavery. It's not even just a story about how terrible slavery was, but in fact about how resilient those slaves were, and how good they were, how faithful they were about holding on to aspects of culture, about creating lives for themselves. Another of the books based on that research is kind of about what we did behind the owner's back and the culture and community we were able to create when they worked for us. That's why the emphasis is from sundown to sunup, the world that we made. So there is still a wealth of that kind of material available in the sources. Minnesota farmers were interviewed, Minnesota farm women were interviewed, laborers were interviewed. So we have an ability, if we use those documents still, to tell new stories and to continue to tell new stories. And this state also about the Indian population in this state. So, there's a man named Lewis Hyde, who some years wrote a book called The Gift. And The Gift is about different ways that artists create community. Most of us live not in a gift economy, but artists and scholars live in a gift economy. Most of us live in the larger culture where a man of substance, and this is his language, a man of substance is known by how much he has. Artists, writers, historians, scholars live in a gift economy where people are known by how much they give away. Now, obviously people have to pay for my books and it's a commercial encounter, but no scholar ever makes back what we invest in what we write. No artist, very few artists make back what we invest. We live in a community where we give our work away, right? We give it to students, we give it to colleagues, we publish it in Minnesota History, we publish it in the Journal of American History. We give it away. What I think artists and writers need is to be acknowledged for what we have to give away, and to make it possible for us to continue to give it away, to contribute to the society in the way that intellectual scholars and artists have the ability and the desire to do. I wish you well in your task. I think you have a wonderful opportunity here, and I certainly would be thrilled to be involved in whatever way I can, and I thank you for inviting me.
Oh, thank you so much. Any questions, comments? We're supposed to set the groundwork, the foundation, because we want to get the most bang from our buck on the constitutional amendment money. And that the people, 56% of people voted yes to spend 33% of the money on outdoor heritage and habitat. 56% of people voted yes to spend 33% of the money on clean water and parks and trails and arts and cultural heritage. And we are in a time where we heard the governor's budget last week, where we have to have a smaller budget than we've ever had in the last 2 years. And we have to find $5 billion to do the ordinary kinds of things in our budget. And it seems to me that the kind of lessons that were learned from the time period that you talked about and the challenges that you reminded us of fit in the categories that people have expectations for wise use of that sales tax bill. And so the foundation is there, and you have given us crumbs of inspiration to remember as we develop our plan of how we're going to develop the funds and the activities that the funds will be spent on. And perhaps what's gone before, although you can never go back, but we certainly can grasp some of Henry Hopkins' vision and some of the good things that happened when we invested in people to do the same kind of things that the people are expecting from us. And we certainly have growing every week. We hear new unemployment problems in this state. Unemployment, people going out of work, people being laid off. And wouldn't it be nice and good for the community if the people were industrious in things that they knew that were helping the community and the state? And it seems to me that we would be stronger if we did that sort of thing. Back to you, Professor Berman.
Let me say, first of all, that there was more to be gained than just jobs for the unemployed during the period from 1935 to 1941-42. We created, through the arts project, through the theater project, through the writers project, through the music project, we created a cultural renaissance, the likes of which the nation hadn't experienced since the late 19th, early part of the 20th century. A cultural renaissance that laid the foundation for the great explosion of the American art and cultural scene after World War II. In all aspects of our lives, for the first time in the 1930s, in many classrooms in urban communities throughout the nation and in Minnesota, children heard live music for the first time. Of course, musicians had to earn a living, and the WPA project, the music project, allowed them to go into the classrooms to show them, this is a tuba. It sounds this way. This is what you make nice music out of, a tuba. And children were just mesmerized by it. Through the theater project, we brought live theater to people that hadn't seen it before. We brought it in the languages that they knew and understood. For not only did the theater project present plays in English, but they, on the Iron Range, presented plays in Finnish, in Croatian, in the larger cities, plays in Yiddish. There wasn't television. And workers and farmers and poor people didn't have radios to a great extent. So the Federal Theater Project presented living newspapers. They put on stage what was going on in the world. To be sure, it was skewed to the left, to be sure. That's why the Federal Theater Project had some problems. But it did create a basis for the expansion of our theater arts culture after World War II. And of course, those who worked in the theater eventually went to films as well. And of course, one of my teachers became a great drama teachers became a great film maker by the name of Jules Dassin. True, he made most of his films in Europe because he was blacklisted in the United States. But Jules got his start in the Federal Theater Project as a director and writer for children's theater. And he wrote a play and directed the play, which got the theater project in trouble. It was called The Revolt of the Beavers. And I won't go into the details, but The Revolt of the Beavers was, in fact, seen as communist propaganda and got him into trouble and got the theater projects into trouble. But what it did was to create a laboratory for people like Jules Dassin to develop their talent, people like Orson Welles to develop their talent. And this is something that I think enriched us all in ways that those who claim that the New Deal didn't get us out of the Depression probably don't understand or don't want to understand. So I would urge you all to use the funds that come in for the purpose that it was in fact designed. And that purpose is in line with what the New Deal did with the Civil Conservation Corps and the WPA project.
Thank you. Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is absolutely fascinating, and I think we could sit here for hours. I guess of you four, things were different back then, and it's my own personal feeling that the attitudes of people were a little different. I think my grandfather and his father worked harder than we did. I just get that sense from the stories my grandmother used to tell me. But if you could have your wish as to how we focused our efforts or our money, would it be more in line with finding the hidden talent in young artists, be they musicians or painters or a poet, or focusing on what was done during the New Deal, or preserving some of the art or culture that we have? I know over the past few years I've represented an old nursing home in Walker, Agua Chain, and it's been demolished now, and there's a lot of WPA art up there. We tried to capture some of it for the county, but it's all been sent somewhere, some warehouse in the Twin Cities, probably never to see the light of day again. And I was hoping maybe somehow this committee could find a way to put that on display. But would you like to look for new unfound talent, or focus on existing artists that have credibility, or turning an existing artist that has credibility into a teacher to teach young students? I hope I'm not getting too diluted with my question.
May I address your question in a little bit different way? I probably have the most interesting, I probably represent the most interesting community college in the state of Minnesota, because we don't train carpenters, although we need carpenters, but what we do at Vermilion Community College is train young people to work on three of the four items on your list. We have a water quality watershed program. We have natural resource technology program. We have a wilderness management program. That should not be surprising, since the Boundary Waters is outside our back door. But the interesting thing about that is I have a chance to teach students in those programs to the political science program. And if there was a way to provide them with the means to do some of the projects that need to be done in this state, they would leap at that chance. And as I was thinking about this, it struck me that we could create a form of the CCC again, although not the CCC, but there is a model. It's called AmeriCorps. And we could create a Minnesota Corps here in the state of Minnesota
that would provide those young people with the opportunities to do those kinds of projects that are nearest and dearest to their hearts, and still help them provide them with the money to go to school, so that they don't leave Vermilion Community College and whatever four-year college they transfer to, because we have articulation programs with the University of Idaho, University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, University of Minnesota, Crookston, Bemidji State. They end up in an awful lot of debt. And it would be great if there would be a way to use some of this money to create a fund, a Minnesota core, where some of our students and other students in Parks and Rec at Mankato State, for example, would be able to help fund their education. Second, the last point, I happen to come out of public history, and so I can address number four as well. I've been consulting with the Cuyuna Iron Range Heritage Network. They just changed their name. And they are a gung-ho group who wants to preserve and disseminate the history of the Cuyuna Iron Range, but they're getting tired because they have almost no general operating money. And their office manager is a volunteer. She's 75 years old. And their other gung-ho but very tired volunteers are in their 70s and 80s. What they need to do is to be able to hire somebody to run that little historical society, and they need general operating money to do that, because then they can begin to do what you asked about. They can begin to explore all of the possibilities, and they can begin to help the artists in the area, and they can begin to create interesting exhibits. But if there's no avenue for little organizations like that to get access to some of this money, we aren't going to see the wonders that we saw as a result of the New Deal. This is a chance for us to help small nonprofit historical agencies and arts agencies in greater Minnesota to take a leap forward again. If the money is not, if the way the money is disseminated is not complicated and it doesn't wear them out in the paperwork, and there has to be accountability, but it has to also be simplified so that they can make use of it effectively. That would be my recommendation.
Professor LeMay.
Yes. In answer to this, there was a basic philosophy of the New Deal art, which was to bring together the people who had the talent, or you might say the expertise, with the common people, and to have an interaction between them. And so if you say, should we inspire new talent, what happened when these highly skilled artists went into the local communities, they did nurture new talent. And that was one of the geniuses of it, to try to break down this division between what you might call the expertise and common people. And another thing they did, when you painted these murals in these small towns, they would have what we would now call focus groups, but they were even bigger. They would ask for people to come together in a town meeting and say to themselves, what type of mural do we want for this town? And there would be questionnaires sent out. And one of the great evidences we have of what kind of murals and what did people think of them, because we can now look at these questionnaires that were sent out. You've got to have this interaction between what you might call the experts or the academics or the artists who have already got professional positions with people at the grassroots. And something exciting comes out of that. And people who experienced it, both the experts and you might say the people at the grassroots, remember that interaction. And that was one of the keys to making it successful, and that kind of creative spark that occurred.
Follow up.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I got some of the perfect answers that I was looking for, and I hope the Chair Wagenius was listening very closely.
Oh, very.
Thank you. We have the Conservation Corps, which does exactly what she would like to do, and I think they're awesome.
Representative Laffer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to our distinguished, insightful guests.
I'm intrigued with the idea of how in the past the wrestling was done in terms of the social capital and the political capital to decide which communities got which projects and which people got employed. Was it there was a job for everyone and you just figured out which stream you were going to go into? Because I think that's something that we're still going to wrestle with in modern times. There are very different human infrastructure, whether it's dealing with environmental issues or whether it's dealing with arts or historical challenges. I think sometimes our smallest communities have the most developed human to scale infrastructure. You know, there's a historical society in a small community that's actually connected to the seniors who live there and them as resources, where the Hennepin County Historical Society has very little relationship to the core of the population that lives there. And so how did we wrestle with that in the past, having studied it, and what guidance would you give us in the future to deal with that issue?
Professor Atkins.
I would start by saying that the characteristic of that whole New Deal relief program was that it was organic, that nobody knew at the beginning what it was going to look like in a few years. So even my hero, Harry Hopkins, didn't stand up and say, okay, we need to do this and this and this and this. He started with that question. And I think an essential piece of what we would do now has to grow out of what our contemporary circumstances are, that it needs also to develop organically. I wouldn't recommend picking up any WCA structure and locating it here, but to try to ask that question. But we have organizations that are already set up and have a history of bringing people together. I sat for a long time on the Grants Review Committee of the Minnesota Historical Society, and one of the things that was wonderful about being on that committee was seeing people from, well, in my case, the sisters from the Monastery of St. Benedict coming to request money from the state. Some was passed through from the federal government and some was state funds to work on their little museum. They knew what they needed. So we weren't going out, the Historical Society wasn't going out and telling them what they needed. But they had an opportunity to define and identify what they needed and come and ask us. Stanley Romanstein was here earlier too in the Humanities Committee, which did the same thing. People could identify what their local needs were and come to a body and ask for that. And it would seem to me, particularly given the kinds of things that Larry's talking about bringing the experts and the public together, it's very helpful to have some structure to facilitate that coming together. But that would be the one essential piece that I think also would need to be there. It's to have people like me talking to people like Sister Ruth Nierengart. If she knows what she wants, I know how to help her get there. And there are lots of partnerships that we can set up. And if I could make sort of one little diversion, remember in the 1920s in the United States, artists left. They left. We have this sort of whole dispersion of artists that happened in the 1920s. I mean, our own favorite son, F. Scott Fitzgerald, who left, never really came back. Right? Sinclair Lewis left, only came back intermittently. Right? In the 1930s, the artists stayed. They stayed here. And so that's what I think, if we can, what do we want to have happen here? Who do we want to have be here? Who do we want to take care of? Whose voices do we want to hear? We can start with that question and use some of these organizations to help us facilitate. I think we have a chance of also speaking to the other representatives' questions about, are we going to preserve art or start to find out what people identify as their own community, local, regional needs. They have to tell us, we have to set up a structure in which we can live.
Representative Khan.
Yes, Madam Chairman, and I guess I know David Kelleher is here. I recall at one point the Historical Society had a program of local grants, and I wondered if that was the kind of thing that the aid that this
Communa Historical Society could access, where local grants were only for the, if they were for those kind of people-oriented projects, or were they only for the restoration of property? I don't know if you have. Yes.
Mr. Kelleher?
And if it still exists, and how it's fair in the governor's budget.
Can you help the Cuyuna?
There's the mic, sir.
People!
Madam Chair, Representative Khan, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. For over 40 years, we have operated competitive grant programs that have served the needs that have been discussed up here at the table and the needs that you referenced. And those grant programs are dependent on the funding sources, whether they're federal, state general fund, state bonding, or other. And the Grants Review Committee that Annette referenced is a citizen group made up of citizens from our board and at-large members, and they fund a variety of needs, ranging from publications, bricks and mortar, when funds are available at that level, publications, microfilm machines, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a mechanism in place that can help with this type of a need that's out there.
But pretty seriously reduced in its ability to fund in the last 5 years.
And rarely any general operating.
Okay,
you were expressing a need for.
That was kind of my question. Yeah. How has it changed over the last 3 years
and I think it really has depended on funds that are available. Really the number of general fund dollars that are available for whether it's general operating support or specific projects is tiny. It's very, very small. And the number of dollars from bond funds is much, much larger. But as you all know, those funds carry a lot of restrictions. They're bricks and mortar, they're available to public entities, et cetera, et cetera. So we have to slot the funding source into the restrictions that they come with.
At future meeting, we're going to have some different approaches to awarding funding and things like that we'll get into this a little bit in more detail. Representative Virginia.
Well, then I'll wait for my future meeting.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Berman, I'm looking for kind of an example of maybe how projects could work. I know in my district I have a group of learned experts that meet in one of the restaurants every Friday or every so often on a Friday, and they have a great deal of experience and knowledge and aren't shy in talking about history and advice, and you may know that group, but having a writer come in there or recording history, would that be the type of thing that...
Well, I'm sure that all of us would be willing to work in any kind of collaborative effort to try to help fulfill your objective. Of course, I remember a time when I served on a committee giving out funds when there was a little bit more leeway during the Bicentennial Commission. You remember that? Rudy Perpich was the chair of the Bicentennial Commission, and since he was a good friend of mine, he said, would I join it? And I did, and I remember having a lot of fun giving out money for worthy causes, all of them cultural, all of them having to do with grassroots participation and the kind of interaction between the professional, artist, musician, historian, with the communities involved. And that kind of interaction, I think, is a very important kind of ingredient to create what I like to call a people's culture. And the people's culture is what we're after all.
I might add that the MHS grant program funded the research for the Otter Tail County book. At the time, there was a lot of money available, and they funded the project overall probably cost $100,000 in the end, and they funded at least half of that for the Historical Society, and it allowed us to hire a professional researcher who went out into every township in Otter Tail County in her high heels and sitting in the chicken coops looking at township records. She was an amazing woman, high heels and all. But without the Minnesota Historical Society's massive amount of money at that time, that project would never have happened. And what we know about the New Deal in Minnesota and how it worked at the grassroots would not be available to us today. So those grants were very, very important in moving forward our knowledge of history in this state.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you for letting me sit in on the only committee that has any money to spend this biennium. But, you know, I'm very well acquainted with two of the guests up there. And as Ms. Brunfeld said, she comes from my district, and her parents, her mother's still alive, good Finn lady, and her dad, and she's 100% Finn herself, but they always had nice signs in their yard. So I appreciate her being down there. You know, my father and mother grew up in the Depression, and my dad always was totally just revered Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And for two reasons that he taught me, with a sub-reason. And number one being that when he went to work in the CC camps, and by the way, members, you know, my mother died this June, my dad 6 years ago. And it was kind of sad and fun at the same time, emptying out 60 years of memorabilia out of my mother's and dad's house. But I got charged with being a historian. And in my mother's cedar chest, I found things like the original bills from their house when they built it in 1951. In fact, for the members in the metropolitan area, the taxes on my mother's bare land on the Iron Range in 1951, because of the fact that the natural ore was going down and there was nothing left to mine, were higher in actual 1952 dollars than they are today, because it was so devastating up there. But my dad, in that also, was his picture from the CC camp. I should bring it over to Frank Valentini and Chisholm, who's one of the few people left that could probably identify all those people in that picture, along with his picture from his food camp down in Georgia, rolled up in it. But my dad told me something very interesting one day, and he said, you know, in the 30s, there wasn't much to do. And we had a choice to go off in a direction like Bonnie and Clyde, or go off and do something constructive. And most of us took that charge and went off and just learned a trade or learned something constructive. And it was the CC camps, and basically the boot camp atmosphere of the CC camps that, taught them that. And there is a good Minnesota Conservation Corps, yes, the directors out here in the audience. And Madam Chair, I think what we have to do in a time when we don't have much money to work with is worry about the second thing my dad said was so important about the Depression and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, is that he gave us a middle class in this country, and he allowed me to go up against U.S. Steel and form a union. And I heard our president talking about the middle class the other day and how important it is and how important he thinks it is, because he made Joe Biden in charge of his tax committee. And I heard him talk about collective bargaining and unions, which I haven't heard for years in this country, which makes me proud. But I think your charge is to use your money wisely and think about when you fix the environment and when you have an outdoor heritage council, and when you have a clean water charge, that you also have to consider the situation we're in, because I don't think we've ever been in a situation like this. It could be worse than the Depression. I talked to my District 11 director for the steel workers, and we could have none of the mines running by the end of the year on the Iron Range because of what's going on in this country. So I think that's all of our charge here, is to use money wisely, and whether it's your committee or a few others like the LCMR or whomever, that when we're fixing the environment and helping the arts, that we look for a way to maximize that money, create as many jobs for that middle class that Delano Roosevelt and Barack Obama care about, and that's what we have to do, because in the end, Madam Chair, you got the gavel and you make the decisions.
and the legislature makes the decision, regardless of what kind of recommendations you get from other councils or advisory boards or whatever.
Well, we certainly appreciate the guidance we're receiving tonight. Is there anything else? Representative Houston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had occasion the other day to be visited by the Ramsey County Historical Society people who said something very similar to what I was hearing from Ms. Brunfeld today. And what I had suggested to them is I really thought local historical societies had to get together. I mean, one of the things we do need to sort of be open-minded about is what we are hearing from them. And I heard the same thing from them about they are trying desperately to hang on to this heritage that's all over the state, but they did talk about the operating dollars as being this great challenge, particularly now with private builders not being quite so interested in this. And I had asked that they would identify some counties, so if you have some counties who would like to be part of this, then we were going to ask to sit down with the State Historical Society and just talk about some new concepts that might be out there. So if you have any counties that you'd like to recommend to us, we would make contact with them.
Well, I would certainly recommend in outstate or in greater Minnesota, I would recommend Stearns County Historical Society, Winona County Historical Society,
Nicholas
County, the Faribault County,
Dakota
County, Clay County.
And the thing to know is that Davidson, this year, at the Historical Society, already has a network of local and county historical societies. And it's mostly been an information-based network. And they, you know, they say, we have display cases that we don't need, if anybody else needs them, so there's some of that. But that would be a really wonderful thing to strengthen. Because there is already a network set up, so you wouldn't have to reinvent the network. And I know that Priscilla Farnham is a part of that, like she posts things that she put on that site. But that would be a way to begin to make real contact with lots of, and there are economies of scale that certainly could be taken advantage of if many of these local places began buying things together, ordering things together, using consultants together, and so the structure is there, but it hasn't been used for that kind of thing because there haven't been any funds funneled through that.
And the other aspect of that is the ones that we mentioned tend to be the most organized, most have professional staff, and so they can provide leadership to organizations like the Cuyuna Iron Range Group I mentioned. So if there would be a way of providing them, the leaders within the local history community, with some funds to be able to afford to go and do some consulting work, that would also be excellent, because right now there's just not a lot of money available for that kind of thing. But they can provide the professional leadership if they have some resources to do so.
Thank you. Is there any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Mr. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, I'd just add quickly that we would agree with all of what's been set up here, and to Representative Hausman's point about talking to the County Historical Society, we've begun that process. We had a series of meetings in December and January all around the state, Grand Rapids, St. Cloud, St. Peter, to talk to county historical societies and others doing this work, to let them know about the points in the constitutional amendment and to gather input. We've got pages and pages of flip charts that we're digesting. So that process has begun.
Can I say one more thing?
Professor Atkins.
You can see from that historians are often, and even American studies people, have plenty to say about most everything. The other thing is that I think that right now I'm in a really privileged position in that I'm a tenured full professor at an institution that is not going to eliminate the history department. And the American studies, none of us is going to be eliminated. So there are a lot of us who are also available for no money.
I've already been eliminated. I'm the son of a...
But so another way to think about this is what are the resources that we already have that aren't going to cost us anything? I mean, that for very little, you could get me to work with half a dozen of those county historical societies. Because it's, I mean, it's also part of that gift economy. It's also part of what I do. It's, and it wouldn't take very much to build some more of those coalitions.
Well, we're certainly going to keep that in mind. And Representative Rukavina?
Well, Madam Chair, I just wanted the committee to know that, you know, I've been to Representative Murphy's house, a beautiful New Deal house, and both Franklin Roosevelt and your dad would be proud of you because you haven't changed much. But what he did do, and I have to tell this, is these beautiful statues that he had commissioned for her, of her and her brother, placed around the property, which was just one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. And so, Madam Chair, you've got the right committee. I'll say that.
And I will say that Representative Rukavina was there because he was offered to be my lumberjack. And he brought his chainsaw. And he worked in 90 degree weather for over 2 hours.
300.
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, I'll move the minutes of Monday, January 26th meeting as submitted.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Professor Berman, Professor Brumfeld, Professor May, Professor Atkins, thank you so very, very much. We appreciate your inspiration that you shared with us tonight, and do not be surprised if we call on you again. This meeting is adjourned.